Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. My name is Dúlta Doherty, and in this podcast series, I will be speaking to investors, advisors, entrepreneurs, and recruiters who are based all over the world, and we'll be discussing how to set up, scale, and operate a world-class recruitment company. Today, I'm going to bring you to Sydney. I'm speaking with Edward Freeman. He runs his own boutique specialist recruitment firm in aged care and medical. And he's been over in Sydney for quite a while now. He left the UK as a young guy to play a bit of cricket over there and ended up staying. He's got about 10 people working for him now, along with his business partner. And they're going from strength to strength. So we had a great chat on some of the challenges that he faces as a business owner, what he wants to do next. And he's been a bit of a fan of the podcast. So he said it's allowed him to hear what other people are doing and to reconfirm some of the things he's doing well and give him the confidence to try some things that he thinks may help his business. So great chat with Edward, lovely lad, and a great story. And, you know, he set himself up over there and made a real go of it, and hats off to him. So I hope you enjoy this one. Really enjoy chatting to Edward. Very free-flowing conversation. He's interested in the industry. He loves talking about his business. And yeah, he's just a nice bloke who is doing really well. So love doing a bit of work in Sydney, and I love getting to chat to people over there. I love the recruitment scene in Australia. It's really positive. It's really competitive as well. So I hope you all get a bit of an insight into it. And I suppose on a personal level, I kind of figured out that maybe I've missed a bit of a niche not moving healthcare recruiters over to Australia. I've always just focused on IT, finance and engineering. So he was able to point out to me that I've probably missed out on quite a lot for that. So apologies if I've given the wrong information to people who are not in IT, finance, engineering. You can get to Australia afterwards. Oh, just wasn't through me. All right. Thanks very much. And we will be back with a new guest pretty soon. Edward Freeman, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Walter. How are you going?
Yeah, good, man. So, great to have you on the podcast. How's life in Sydney?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's sunny like it is most of the time, but yeah, no, it's all good.
Are you from Australia originally?
No, I'm from England originally, from Essex.
Where is that Essex accent hiding?
It's weird you say that, because if I speak to any Aussies, they think I sound really English. But if I speak to people back home, they think that I sound really Aussie. So yeah, I can't. Yeah.
The joys of being an expat, I suppose.
Yeah.
So when you've listened to the podcast? So we normally start at the start, where how you got into recruitment. But tell me, how did you end up moving to Australia first off?
I was a massive cricket player when I was younger, and I wasn't someone that was keen to travel. That was never something that interested me as a youngster. But we had an overseas player, an Aussie guy, that came to play for our local cricket club, and sort of got, you know, we became mates. And he said, you know, if you want to come back to Australia and play for my club, I can probably find you a place to stay. So yeah, it was all a bit last minute. I was 17, turning 18. So my parents, paid for me as my 18th birthday present to come over. And so yeah, I came over for 6 months, but I didn't really put too much thought to it. I sort of, you know, being a cricketer in England, you know, thought of going to Australia is a massive, you know, dream. So I sort of turned up. I got picked up at the Sydney airport, and just got dropped off at a family that I was staying with. And I remember I first got there, and I sort of was shown to my bedroom I was staying in. And I sort of walked in and just sort of sat on the bed, head in my hands, and went, "Oh, what have I done?"
Oh no! Oh, yes. What level of cricket was this? I don't really know cricket, so you kind of have to spell it out for me.
Oh, look, it was never anything like professional, anything like that. It was our club in England. Every year we had an overseas player, and so I became mates with that person. And it was only it was sort of, you know, it was an okay standard, but it was just like a local level cricket. So I came to a place called Blacktown in Australia, and my thoughts of Australia were from mum watching Neighbours and Home and Away. So I had this image in mind of what it was like, and I ended up in Western Sydney, and it wasn't quite.
You more of a Neighbours or a Home and Away guy?
Oh, it was much more towards Home and Away. It wasn't Ramsey Street. It wasn't all the picturesque, you know, cul-de-sac with all the nice big houses. It was a few wooden shacks in the street that I was living on. So it wasn't quite, what I thought it was going to be.
And was that but it? From, you just ended up staying in Australia. Was that, you didn't go back home?
Yeah, no. From that was 2001, and from that, I was only meant to stay for 5 months for the cricket season. And and it was getting near the end, and I was actually sort of getting a bit fed up, and I was keen to get back. And just I ended up meeting an Aussie girl, and then it went from there. We sort of hit it off, and then she ended up coming over to England for a while. We went back there, and then we just went backwards and forwards for a while. And the sort of the sensible decision was to sort of try and settle in Australia, and sort of got my visa through her. We were together 6 years, wow. And then by the time we broke up, you know, I was pretty settled. So that was that.
Shout out to that Aussie girl for getting you the visa.
Yeah, yeah, massive. Yeah, yeah, it was nice. Was there
no pressure to go to uni and that from your parents?
That's a bit of a sore point because I didn't go to uni. I went to college. I did high school, then went to college, and I sort of convinced my parents that, you know, maybe I could become a professional cricketer, and this sort of travelling over to Australia was the way forward. But I knew I was never going to be professional. I knew that, but. It was a way to sort of avoid going to uni, and I'm still the only person in our office that doesn't have a uni degree, so it does get brought up every now and again, and I do get ridiculed for it.
Yeah, well, I you're probably around my age, Edward. Are you? What age are you?
I'm 36 in March. I think you're similar, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm 36 in July. Like, I think going to uni was kind of more expected then. Then like I don't know if there's much value in some of the stuff that they do now. Like, the world has changed so much. Oh. Unless you're going to be like a lawyer or a doctor.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing I miss about, the only thing that I think I missed out on, I would have loved to have gone to a uni, like away from home, and actually done the whole, you know, uni life and all that side of it. I think for life experience, it would have been better for me than the actual degree I would have got at the end of it.
Yeah, yeah. But I think you probably got that from going to the other side of the world and really putting yourself out there. I think it's probably a better journey, but I don't know, you know, each to their own. How did you get your entrance into the recruitment world, like every good Englishman in Australia seems to do?
You're either a tradie or
you're a recruiter.
yeah look, and I'm gonna be boring like everyone else you have on the podcast and say I just fell into it. I, by the time I sort of settled in Australia and all of a sudden I found myself, I didn't have a proper job. I'd only just got a visa to be able to work. I didn't have a degree or any sort of qualifications to speak of. So I actually just started going to recruitment companies just to sort of see if they could find me work. And I ended up sitting in the Hayes reception just to sort of see if they could find me a job. Because at that point, I thought recruitment companies were there to help people. That's what I really thought they were. And when I was sat there on the table in the waiting area, there was a leaflet about, you know, have you thought about being a recruitment consultant? So when I went in, I just said, oh, I've seen the leaflet and keen to know more. So I spoke to that person. She said, oh yeah, I think it could be okay. And she went and got her boss, spoke to her, then she went and got her boss. And then they said, oh look, you could be a good way to go. You know, we'll give you a call. So, you know, a few days later I got a call and they said, yeah, can you come in for a proper interview? And at that stage, I'd never had a corporate job. I'd worked in bars and sports shops and things like
Perfect
that.
Perfect for Hayes.
Oh, well, that's the thing. I turned up super nervous, you know, just shaking. I got there shaking, thinking, oh, what's it going to be like, a proper corporate interview? And then when I turned up, there was about 20 people in the waiting area. And I thought, what's going on here? And then all of a sudden, these people came out and said, right, come through. And then ends up in this boardroom, and there's all your name tags on the table. And then obviously at that point realised it was one of these group interviews, and it was my worst nightmare. It was one of these ones, like the role-playing stuff. And, you know, the first thing was...
They didn't give you any prep for it, no?
No, they didn't even tell me. I didn't know it was going to be that. I thought it was going to be a normal interview. But anyway, I you know, shit myself basically when I turned up, and then but felt I got through it and got more confident as time went on, and thought, oh, I've done okay here. And the woman at the end was talking to me like I basically had the job. And then, you know, a week later, heard nothing, called them up, and they said, no, unfortunately, you haven't got through, so you haven't got a job.
Yeah. For anybody listening, those that group thing in Hayes is weird. Like, it's a weird experience. So you go in there and you'll be with just people from all walks of life, all ages, and you're all around the same table. And then they just start grilling you, and then you're asked to stand up and say why you want to join Hayes, and you have to give I have to give this speech, and everybody's doing it, so reinforce, and each person's trying to outdo the next. You would swear like you were trying to get you were trying to get a job playing for Man United or something, you know.
I get what they're doing now. Obviously they just cast the net really wide, get you all into these group meetings or interviews, and then whoever just shines and seems really out there and can just talk away, then they get a start, don't they? And everyone else just gets told to go. So
and you were told to go, hey?
Didn't make it.
We're at a low point here, but
So from there, I was
turned down for the first three recruitment jobs I went for when I was 20, 21, 22, and I didn't get into it till I was 27. But you probably had a bit more resilience straight off the bat. How did you get your entrance?
Well, after that, I thought, well, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to try again and get into recruitment. I went for another interview and I got down to the last two, and I wasn't selected for that one. So that was the second failure. And then I then saw another advert on Seek for a recruitment consultant. So I phoned up and they said, yeah, come in for an interview. Sat with a guy and I thought, oh, I've done really well in this interview. This has gone really well. And then at the end he said, yeah, look, you've done really well. So he said, but yeah, I've got three companies here I'm going to put you forward to. So it turned out he was one of your lot. He was one of the Rector X. So I didn't know that. So that was it.
See, that there type of stuff, like I don't think you can get away with that, no. You know, like being hustled into an interview and then being sold on to somebody else. I don't know if any, like, do Rector X still do that?
I've got no idea. Yeah. I don't think he did it on purpose. I think it just, he assumed I knew he was a Rector X. But at that stage, I was young. I hadn't had a proper job and I was just sort of going with the flow. I didn't really know what was happening.
Yeah.
But at the end, he sort of said, I've got this company of two guys, just two directors that have started a company. And I think it'd be good to go along and meet with them. And I know, and I later found out that he sent my resume across to them and they just screwed up and threw it in the bin, which is fair enough, because I had no right to sort of get a recruitment job. I had a limited sales background. There was nothing there to say that I should get a job.
Or for somebody to pay a fee for you.
Oh, exactly.
You know, like with what we do, like not everybody should use a recruiter, you know. You need to be worth the fee, really, I think, don't you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah, so yeah, why they paid a fee. But the recruitment guy, he sort of talked them into having a chat with me, and they still didn't want to go to the extreme of getting me in for a face-to-face. So I just got a call one night at home. And yeah, I must have sort of done all right in that chat with one of the directors. And then they called me in and yeah, ended up hiring me. So it was just that it was a small company, two-man band. And I was the first ever, you know, employee that they brought on.
What were you recruiting for?
That was engineering back then. It was structural engineering. And like so different to what I do now, in the sense that I think it was much, for that job in particular, it was much tougher. Like it was pretty much every one of my deals was headhunting back then. Like that's all I did. Whereas now, luckily, I don't have to do as much of that. But yeah, it was just, there was a lot of competition. It was super candidate short. It was hard to get any information out of the clients to sort of differentiate them from the next engineering company. Projects was probably the best thing to try and sell it on.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like being a rector.
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. But yeah, it just seemed a lot more, you know, full on when I started doing recruitment. The way I learned, I think one of my old bosses, he'd sort of come from England and he'd come a bit more from that, you know, hardcore recruitment sales environment.
Mm.
So when I was learning, he was, you know, they'd teach me how to do the first call and I'd be sort of nervous talking to a client. And then yeah, he would be in the background banging his head on the table because I'd said something wrong. So I'm sort of trying to concentrate on the call, and I could see him out the corner of my eye banging his head on the table. I've done something wrong, and yeah, I just didn't, yeah, just a nervous wreck at the start, but it worked. I seemed to sort of get in the deep end, and it went all right.
You were there for quite a while, right?
Yeah, that's the only other company I worked for. So I joined them in 2005, and went through to, well, we all got fired or let go essentially during the GFC, because we did engineering, construction, mining, all the industries that just went out the window when the downturn came about. So we all sort of got herded into a room and told that, you know, couldn't afford to keep us, and that was it, went off. But then rejoined them after doing this weird sales job in between.
What was your weird sales job?
Oh, so I say it's weird. Maybe other people won't think it's weird, but it was media sales. So it was this company where they would sell advertising space on big screens. So if there's like whenever you have a big screen outdoors, so it might be a sporting event or a festival type thing, and then they would sell the advertising space on there. So, and it's called, I hadn't heard it before. It's called distress selling. So you basically sat in this room with all the other salespeople, and then there was a sales director at one end of the room, and you just had a pitch that you had to follow. So what I found strange with this job, in recruitment, I really enjoyed it because you got taught how to do it, and then you could sort of run with it in your own way and do your own thing, think for yourself. Whereas this was, you've got a pitch, you sit there, you do this pitch, and you're selling this advertising space on these big screens. And the thing you had to do, whether it was a small company or Coca-Cola, whoever you were trying to sell into, you had to go to the top person, like the CEO in the company. Because the thinking was that if you get to that person at the top, then they would sort of filter back down, and then you could sort of say, oh, so-and-so told me to give you a call. And it was meant to, that was their whole way of selling. And it was just once you've got that person on the phone, and bearing in mind, you know, you might have to, once you've managed to trick your way into finding their number, you might have to keep ringing it because their PA would answer. And the thinking was eventually that PA would go to the toilet or something, go and get a coffee, and then that person would answer. So,
what a nightmare.
Oh, yeah, it was crazy. And as soon as that person answered, that was it, bang, straight into the pitch. So you're running through this pitch. And if you got so far down the page, it was thought that you'd got them hooked a little bit. So the sales director at the end of the room would come running over to you. You'd have to stand up. And this is where I found it really strange. She would then press a button on the phone. And so you'd be speaking in the receiver. You'd turn the receiver upside down, so you're speaking into the mouthpiece. So they're hearing you through the mouthpiece on the receiver, but then they're coming out of the phone as a loudspeaker. So effectively what happens is the sales director takes over the call. She listens to what's being said, and then she stands opposite you and she starts answering what they've said. And you've got to watch her mouth and copy like a millisecond behind her what she's saying. Like, you've effectively become a robot saying, so she takes over the call and goes through you as a robot. It was the strangest thing.
That is strange. So tell me, why did you rejoin the company? Is it Nascent? Is that what you call them?
Yeah, Nascent, they were called. Yeah.
Nascent.
Yeah.
Why did you rejoin them instead of thinking, oh, you know, you sacked me last time with everybody else? Like, I'll take my experience and go somewhere else.
I ultimately got fired from that sales job because I didn't believe in it at all, and just sort of stuck around 3 or 4 months, got fired. And then just around that time, my old boss got in touch and said, oh, look, things have picked up again in the recruitment world, in the mining world. Why don't you come back? We can. And then he sort of talked about me coming back and being a manager of a team and all this kind of stuff. And it was more that comfort of just knowing what I was going back to. I really didn't even think about going anywhere else. Which probably, looking back, it probably would have been a good experience for me to go somewhere else and learn some new things.
So you did the next few years there. What could that guy have done to keep you in his business?
I don't know. And this is what I find really interesting in terms of us trying to recruit and find people to come, experienced recruiters to come and join us, because it seems that most people sit in their roles and they just go along with whatever happens. And it sounds like there's quite a few people out there that don't have a very good situation, not very good commission or no perks, but I don't know. It just seems a reluctance to sort of look elsewhere. And I suppose I was the same. I became sort of quite good mates with my bosses, and and the people in the office had some mates there and stuff. And yeah, I just sort of never really felt a need to go looking elsewhere.
No, fair enough. How did it come about that you set up your own business? Why did you go into a different niche? How did that whole thing come about? Did you set up by yourself? Like, walk me through what that day looked like that you left. You left the nascent group and went and did your own thing, essentially.
So I think when I joined them, because I was the first person they took on, I saw the company grow. And from an early stage, I used to think, I could imagine doing this myself in the future. I was all quite ambitious to start my own company from an early point. Not right then, but I knew I was going to do it in the future. And I was quite open with my boss at saying that in the future I wanted to do that. And went through all this. And in the background, I was sort of putting money away and saving in case it ever did happen. So I had a bit of money behind me. And it needed a catalyst for me to go and start by myself. I'm hoping I would have done it anyway, but what happened was it was Christmas time in 2011, and we ended up having our Christmas party on the Thursday night instead of a Friday. And I was a massive pain in the arse in my old company. The thing I got into trouble for all the time was being late, and my old boss was an absolute stickler for lateness. And I'm talking, if you got in at 8:31, 8:32, you were late, and he saw that as a direct sort of, you know, taking the piss out of him for being late. And I'm just a late person. I've always been bad with it. So we went out on the Thursday night, obviously got really drunk at our Christmas party. And then he said, well, the next day you can come in at 9 o'clock instead of 8:30. So it gave us a half hour leeway after having our Christmas party and staying out till 2 a.m. or whatever it was. So rather, you know, it was quite inevitable. I ended up turning up at about 9:10 instead of 9. And I walked through the door and I sort of quite hungover. I walked through the door and he just unleashed on me and in front of the whole office. And to the point where at the start, I thought he was joking. But he just went mad at me and just started going, "This, you're pathetic," and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we just had an argument in front of the office. And that's, yeah. And he sort of said, I said, "Well, if you're going to talk to that, I might as well go." And he said, "Well, if you're going to go, don't bother coming back." And I said, "I won't come back." And that was it. I sort of stormed out. And as soon as I got out, I thought, it's just an argument. We're both hungover. It doesn't really matter. And I got home and I had a few things to do. I had an interview planned or something for a candidate. So I went onto my laptop and try to log in and my password has all been changed.
Wow.
And then I thought, maybe it's serious. But it was honestly the best thing that ever happened to me, because there and then I thought, I think I spoke to my family and a couple of mates. I said, well, maybe this is the sign to go and start your own thing. And that's what I did. And I had my now business partner, Josh. We'd always sort of sat there and talked about starting a business one day. And I had this big argument with my boss out of nowhere, started and said to my Josh at the time, "Look, I think I'm going to go for it. I'm going to do it. Do you want to come with me?" And it all came out of nowhere. And he was a bit like, "Oh, look, I'm not really ready for it." And he was owed a load of commission as well. So he said, "Oh, look."
What was Josh's background?
Pretty much the same as me. He came into Nascent probably a year or two after I did. And then we became mates and we sort of just talked about starting a company one day. And he sort of fell into it as well.
Same that guy me. Who gave you the dress down in front of everybody, was he the owner of the company or was he just a manager?
No, he was the owner. Yeah, he was
the owner. Was the owner. Right, okay.
And it was sad, because we were actually quite good mates. And looking back now, look, I was young, I was a bit of a pain in the ass. I was late a lot. And I was a sort of single guy in Sydney, and I was always coming in with my problems from outside the office. And luckily for me, we've never had an employee like what I was when I was there. So I was always a good biller, but I was always a bit of a pain in the ass. So I could see why I used to wind him up. But
yeah. I think I'm a bit of a pain in the ass as well. I can empathize.
Oh, yeah. I was always like, and he used to call me a maverick and things like that. And I probably was. And I was always sort of pushing the boundaries a little bit. And that's how it all blew up. And look, on the day after, he called me and said, "I'll come and have a chat. It's all good." And I just came and said, "Well, actually, I've decided to do something else." And then it certainly went a bit sour though, once he realised that I was going out by myself and essentially going to be a competitor. The old business hat came on, and that was it. He wasn't very happy with me after that. And we haven't really spoken properly since.
Wow. Mm. So that was it. There's no love loss in recruitment when it comes to that type of stuff.
Yeah, he just straight away saw it as a business thing and as a, I suppose, a bit of a threat. And Yeah, and he was quite forward in saying that he was not happy about it, and he was going to do whatever it took to try and stamp my business out, or whatever he said at the time. But yeah, I think he was just a bit emotional at the time.
And whenever he says that, you're a young guy, and he's talking about, like, you know, we'll go after you legally if you go near any candidates or clients.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? How are you planning to get around that? What's your thought process?
Well, first things first, it was a massive motivator. I was already super motivated by not failing. I just really wanted to succeed. And then to have someone sort of telling you that they didn't want your business to succeed as well, it was just a massive motivator. And it was all really strange, because I was the first person they ever employed, and then I left and came back. I didn't actually have a contract. I never had a proper contract. So he couldn't, there was nothing legally that could happen. But even so, I still said, look, I looked into it, and people said, look, they can only hold you to 3 months. So that's what I did. I said, look, I'll give you 3 months, and I won't touch anything that I've been doing when I've been working for you guys. And again, it was another blessing in disguise, because I went and did the other, I was doing West Coast mining recruitment, and I went and did East Coast, and I built up all these new contacts and clients and did really well. And then once I was allowed to go back and do my old stuff, I had more stuff that went together, and it just worked really well. So there was just a couple of things along the way that seemed bad at the time, but that actually worked in my favor.
I was talking yesterday about San Francisco and how it's like a once in a generation recruitment market. I think the same can be said for the West Coast of Australia, mining, engineering, oil and gas, before 2015. Is that the space that you were in?
Oh, it was mental. It was just crazy. Like it, yeah. That year or two when mining in Western Australia just went through the roof. You know, we were hiring people at Nascent, and you didn't have to really recruit. They were essentially just pulling gold or whatever else out of the ground, and they didn't care. They would just get whoever they wanted, and they'd just pay the invoices, and they'd pay, you know, 18-20%, and they were massive salaries. Like, graduates were starting at like 150k, and yeah, I mean, so Nascent would have had a couple of amazing years there in the mining boom, definitely.
Yeah, there was something about being in that boom. Like, I was lucky. I 2011 when I started, and, you know, just being able to build like 100 grand in my first ever quarter in recruitment, yeah, without actually knowing what I was doing. Like, I didn't have a clue what I was doing, and when I look back now, I'm like, oh, that was pretty lucky. Like, I got into that there space at that time, and that was in IT. The engineering thing was even crazier. When I was interviewing, I remember I had an offer to do engineering in Hayes, and I turned it down. And the guy who runs their engineering practice, Jim Fearon, was like, "You don't know what you're turning down here. You don't know enough to turn this down." And when I look back now, I'm like, "Oh yeah, that was probably a slight mistake."
Yeah, missed it there. And the funny thing was that, in all fairness, so the boss that I had that falling out with, the other director, he was the one that actually out of nowhere came up with the idea to do mining, and I was doing well on my engineering desk. He said, "Oh, Ed, do you want to come and do mining with me?" And I made about 5 phone calls and got told basically, "No, I don't need any help." And I just went, "No, nothing in mining, terrible area, I'm not interested, I'm going back to engineering." But luckily, like, he carried on with it and persevered, built it up, and then luckily I got to go back into it, which was good.
Yeah, that was a fun time. How did that lead you into aged care? Did the crash in the mining industry affect you?
Yeah, it was just the same old thing. We'd gone through it twice, because when the GFC hit, you know, we were doing really well. I was doing engineering then, and then obviously just as good as it was, it just completely came to a halt. And then that's when I left and did that other job, and then I went back to them, and that's when I was doing mining, and the mining market came back really strong again. And then same thing, it just went on a massive downturn again. So we'd gone through two occasions of it just completely disappearing. So I'd started E4, the company, and I did mining that first year. And that's when it just went downhill. But I remember...
Yeah, I remember looking at the commodity prices and being in my chair in Perth. And I just bought some stocks in some iron ore companies. Oh, no. And they were just disintegrating down. And
And I went up to my director at the time and I said, hey, are you keeping an eye on the commodity prices? And he said, yeah, how fucked do you think we are? And I said, I think I'm out of here in 6 months.
Yeah.
And we did. We let, like, it, that was it. Like, yeah, it was just that being in that, like, if anybody can ever get to a mining boom whenever it happens, it's unbelievable.
There's talk of it happening again.
Oh, man.
Slight whispers. So we've got, definitely got our eye on it because, yeah, it's just starting to come back a little bit. So, yeah, let's see what happens.
Yeah, it's like if basically, what, for anybody's listening, how that happens is China just decides that they're going to build 5 new cities. They don't really care if people live in them, but it's to keep their own economy up and pumping. And where do they get their iron ore? Essentially, is Queensland and more to the point, Western Australia. And when China decides that, actually, do you know what? We don't need this anymore. The commodity price drops. And that's how the whole boom and bust cycle works with it in Western Australia. And then it's tied into the oil and gas market as well, where that there's more on the OPEC global scene. So, but they kind of almost run hand in hand, you know? So.
Oh, it's been great for Australia. I mean, for Australia's economy, just, you know, mining's just always been the one that's held them up and, you know, kept them out of, you know, these economy problems. It's always, you know, been what they've relied on, isn't it? And like, say, China. And yeah, so it's been good for them.
So how did aged care recruitment? Come on now, it's not the sexiest field to be recruiting in.
No, it's not, no. From the sort of champagne razor blades thing with the mining, engineering, whatever else, I remember speaking to someone after the first GFC and talking to someone that did healthcare and aged care recruitment and sort of saying, oh, what happened to you in the GFC? Did you lose your job as well? And he just went, no, not, I didn't feel it at all. Didn't affect me. And I just, and obviously from that point, the light bulb just went off and said, right, the next time it all goes tits up, I'm going to go into healthcare. And so I started E4. I did a year of mining, which again it was awesome because I just timed it really well. Able to build, you know, start the company and build up some money and build up a bit of a foundation. That went downhill. My now business partner Josh came back into the frame. We started talking about joining up, and that's what happened. Then we decided at that point, look, you know, find a market that's going to be, you know, more sustainable, and that's what we did. We jumped into healthcare, and we just worked extremely hard to get it off the ground, and went from there.
So healthcare is in the UK. It's a tried and tested route, and there's an unbelievable amount of agencies. But in Australia, none of the big boys really touch it compared to IT and finance and engineering. So there probably is a bit of a niche that you were able to get at without having the same competitive levels. Why is it that there isn't as much pharmaceutical recruitment in Australia as there is in the rest of the world?
I'm not sure. There definitely is recruitment in that area because I know some of our competitors do it. It's not something that we've dabbled in, but we're you know, really looking to grow now and we'll look at that market. But I don't really know too much about the pharmaceutical, but I think it probably is going to get busier there. And in terms of it being niche, I mean, in the healthcare sector, the talk over in Australia for quite a while now has been about the healthcare industry. And so it does get hit a lot in the media. And I think a lot of the companies are starting to move into it. But that's an interesting one. And you'd know more because you worked for one of the big guys, didn't you? Was it Robert Walters that you worked for?
Mm.
And I'm not putting down the big guys in any way, but all the markets I've ever done, whether it be engineering, mining, you know, aged care, healthcare, whatever, I've always found that the recruiters from the big guys like your Hayes and all that, they've never really been a threat. I've always found that I've competed mostly against other little boutique recruiters or companies. So I don't know if that's just been a coincidence, it just happened that way, but I just never found that a threat from the big guys in the industries I've done.
Well, I think a lot of the big guys, if you're running a good desk there, you'll have a few major accounts. So you'll be leaning towards them quite a bit. Even if you speak to them, they'll say, "Oh, I built it from scratch and I did this." Not so sure.
Yeah, no, you didn't. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you didn't. Because I've done that and I used to say that. And no, I didn't build it from scratch.
Yeah, for the first one to say it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, big time. Well, I mean, I know that I've got things to compare it to. I'm aware of it. But back then I was like, oh, Robert Walters were nothing without me. So, yeah. You know what I mean? But you know, you evolve over time, don't you? I think a lot of the big boys compete with other big boys on those big accounts. And they sporadically fill jobs with the remainder of their shortlists. So they're not working as many positions in tiny little businesses. And look, it really just depends. And I suppose the other thing is, if you're against good small businesses, they might be business owners or shareholders or people who are kind of in it for the long run, where if you can get 18 months out of somebody at a big firm, you're doing well, you know. Yeah. Unless you're like, I mean, they'll all have to say, no, we've got no turnover. That's lies.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, so, they're obviously pumping out. I mean, I think Greg Savage put something on LinkedIn the other day about the money that, you know, he's been talking a lot about the amount of money in recruitment at the moment. And I think he put up the figures that all of the big guys have been making, and it was just massive. So, I mean, they're obviously doing something right.
Yeah, look, we're at the top of the market.
Yes.
It's never been this good anywhere. His whole thing, like, his message works, you know, for what it is, you know, that, you know, the industry's not dying, it's growing, that, you know, you need to have people skills as well as embracing the new stuff. And you know, in Australia, he's like treated like a religious figure in the recruitment world, isn't he?
Well, I upset him when I first noticed who he was, and he was pretty, I didn't know how big he was. And when we started at E4, I think I had a little bit of ego, and he put a post up saying that every time you hire a new person, it costs you like over $100,000 or something. And I knew nothing at the time, so I don't know why I got involved, but I think I just put a comment underneath saying basically, oh, that's absolute rubbish or something like that. And yeah, I think he just sort of blasted me a bit and just said I was sort of a silly little boy or whatever, which is probably quite right, really. But I just didn't know how big of a figure he was in Australia, so I sort of regretted that straight away.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't give that a second thought, you know. One of the things I like about him is, and I've said this before, is whenever I was setting up the podcast, I reached out to him and he said, "Yeah, come on, no problem. Don't worry about it. I can't get back. I can't work it out for the next month or two." But he responded to my cold email, as it was, within 24 hours, and that's like, I've had other Johnny big balls in the industry say, "Well, how many downloads do you get?" And then I'm like, "Do you know what? You know, away you go with yourself." You know?
Yeah. Well, in fairness, after I sort of, you know, abused one of his comments for no reason, I've actually called him a couple of times to ask some advice once I realised how sort of big time he was. And he was really receptive, really nice, had a chat to me. And so, yeah, so he seems a nice enough guy.
And well, I think that's his secret. Like, it's not like he's saying anything that's new or revolutionary, but he's an important person and he has time for everybody. And that there's the bit that I'm like, I think a lot of the big shots in the industry could learn a little bit from that. So talk to me about what size are you at right now in your business?
So we were a bit slow in terms of growing. So I think Josh and I are both certainly at the start, we were quite conservative. We wanted to make sure we built a strong foundation and got plenty of money in the bank and did it all properly. So it's only been the last 3 years that we've actually started hiring staff. So we're now at 11.
Wow. Okay. So you got over the magic 10 point.
Yeah.
Including you two?
Yes, including us. Yeah.
Okay, great. So 9, not over the magic stand.
No, yeah. So maybe I'm sort of selling it a bit bigger than what it is. But
that's all right. It's really good.
And we moved to a new office in a month. So we've gone through the usual path. Like, when I first started, it was the proper sat in your bedroom. Then we went to a shared office, Had a couple of interesting characters in there. That was great. And then we moved to an office, our own office, which is sort of just outside the city in a place called Stanmore. And now we've made that jump to get a city office, which absolutely, in terms of, look, it's a business decision because we want to grow. And we know that most recruiters want to work in the city. But it's rent's about 15 times what we pay now, which is a bit hard to swallow. But, you know, we've made that choice, though. And I think it'll be good for us. Ultimately, good for us if we want to go and grow. So,
and Ed, it's not easy to get staff to join you in Australia. And I think I have some of my own thoughts on that, having done the Rector X stuff there for a few years now. Number one, base salaries are ridiculously high. And they're really high if you want to get sponsored, because you have to meet the minimum criteria now of 90,000 Australian dollars. So that makes every hire a really important hire. So that's tough. And then maybe I'm wrong on this, but I kind of feel that middle class Australians see it as an expat job.
Oh, massive! Yeah, massively. Yeah, it's still the joke that, you know, everyone you speak to in recruitment is probably going to have an English accent. So I think it's changing a bit now, but from all the time I've been doing it, very much predominantly English or UK or whatever.
Because my initial experience of it, like when I was with Walters, everybody was English and Irish. Like, nobody survived on the shop floor being Australian. And that was just because, like, you can imagine that mining boom. They didn't even, like, the locals didn't even have to go to uni, you know. They just turn up and somebody pays them 100 grand to do some random construction thing. And as a result, why would you go in and do the hard job of recruitment? And then the people who did have an education looked down their nose on it. So it was a strange kind of strange area for people to grow. But back then, you could take a work and holiday visa, you could sponsor them, you could do all of that, and it wouldn't break the bank. But now companies, like, it's tough to find people and to get people to join you. What's your current strategy to get around that?
Well, a couple of things. We, again, quite fortunate in the sense that, look, we've had a couple of bad hires that just didn't work out. But from the start, the first person that we took on that worked out, Sandra, she was young. She was only about 20, 21, I think, when she joined us. And she'd worked in Nike. She'd had no, sales experience, and she saw our advert for a junior recruiter came in and just seemed really bubbly and chatty. So we gave her a go, and she just, it was like when I joined Nason, it was good because it was only two people, so they were very invested in you succeeding. And that was the same with us with Sandra when she came on. So we just, worked on the training with her, and then she worked out. She's still with us now. And brilliant. And then we took on the next one, which was Candice, who's now on maternity leave, but she was a paramedic, no real sales background, and we trained her up, and she ended up doing extremely well. She was really focused, and she had a couple of massive quarters, and then she went on maternity leave. And then we've got three juniors at the moment that are sort of learning the job. But we've been quite lucky in terms of it working, the people that we've trained up. And then along the way, we've picked up a couple of experienced people as well. But in terms of trying to attract people, Josh and I have really focused heavily on trying to make it the best possible place to work. So we don't do anything groundbreaking, but we've tried to put as many perks in as possible, and because we're always aware as well that we're in Stanmore outside the city, so I think we naturally missed out on some people joining us, because as I said before, experienced recruiters want to be in the city, the whole city lifestyle. We brought in the one thing we did bring in over a year ago now was a one day working from home.
And we
were a bit nervous about doing it.
Do you make them earn it?
Yes. So look, a very sort of achievable monthly target. If I hit that target, then the following month that everyone can have, that person can have a day working from home. And it's really fun.
Per week or per month?
Per week. So every week they can nominate a day and they work from home. And funnily enough, it's almost like, so for some people, that perk is more enjoyable than the money they make. Just being able to not come into the office one day. People, like when they're trying to get their deals over the line, they're really sort of going, I want to get my money through so I can have my day from home. And it's worked really well. And in terms of productivity and everything, it just went up. It was just, know, we were worried that it'd sort of slacken off if that happened, but it's just been really good for us. So,
you know, I haven't scaled out my business at all, really. You know, a few people that work for me.
So, the VAs.
Who are almost recruiters in what they do, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like I log on all the time. Like, you know, I took a client call at midnight last night to close a deal in Australia. And but bigging myself up there.
You haven't sent me any candidates.
You've never asked. Do you know what? I tell you what I was thinking. I probably missed out on placing 100 healthcare medical type recruiters over the years, because we only really focused in on engineering, finance, and IT, because that's where all the demand was. But I'm digressing. When I was working for a company, I loved being able to just log off, and that was it. I'd never log in on the evenings, but I think now, like, well, for me, and people I speak to, recruitment's changed, and people kind of have to be on in the evenings and doing a little bit. Do you find your staff go that extra bit to close the deals, or when they log off, is that it? And is there any way to kind of encourage people to do that? Is that, like, I kind of feel like the days of locking people in an office on set hours, there's only so much you can get out of that. Where if they were to log on and you knew they were, like, doing a couple of hours in the evening, it would nearly be better to kind of give them a bit of freedom.
Yeah, it's funny you bring it up, because it's something that Josh and I talk about a lot, especially recently. It's definitely changed. For me, I said when I used to work my old company, I used to be late. I was always the last one in the office. And the mentality was, my old boss's mentality was, the more you're in the office, the more he likes you and the better recruits you are. So if you're there till 8 o'clock at night working away, then you're doing really well. I just think it's changed. Quite frankly, all our recruiters are very accountable, and they do their work. They do what needs to be done. And the figures and the success has been there. But I find now, with the way things are, it gets to 5:30, people just switch off and they go home. It just seems, I don't know if that's a generational thing or just the world's changed with that, but it's definitely a different mindset. But I can't be too against it, because people are performing. So, and like, I do like the way the world's gone, in the sense that people care more about results now. It's not really about, he was in the office till 9 o'clock last night, how good's he? It's more about, you know, just results. And that's the way it should be, isn't it? So,
well, that's why we got into recruitment from the start, well, most of us anyway, because you're the master of your own destiny. I mean, sure, there's a bit of brown nosing and stuff that goes on, but at the end of the day, like, the numbers are going to be what defines your career. I don't know, since I've worked for myself, I just prefer that option of being able to, you know, do a few hours in the evening. I feel like I'm just working all the time at the moment, but with my own team, I don't have specific sales targets on them, but they do work throughout the day, and then they run their life with kids or whatever they have. And I suppose I don't feel qualified to say that it completely works with salespeople, because they're not like targeted, like, here's your billing figure. So I'd be interested to see how that works.
We've been talking about it recently. Like, we work so hard to try and make ours the best possible place to work, and sometimes I do wonder if we've strayed too far that direction of just trying to worry about making it the best place to work, and then does it lean too far that way, and it's more about enjoy the work ethic's not as high as it would be when these other recruitment companies, where it's like, you know, cracking the whip and stuff. But I think it's just about finding that balance, isn't it, where people are happy and keen to come into work but still getting the results.
Well, you're a boutique, so you have to kind of embrace that if you want to keep people over the years. Yeah. Whereas big companies who can churn and burn, they can get enough out of somebody in a year to make it worthwhile, because they've got two other people coming in, nipping at all the work that they've done. And their cycle just goes and goes and goes. So it's slightly different, isn't it?
Is there a bit of a fear then in the big companies? Is there a bit more fear that if I don't perform, there's someone, you know, snapping at my heels to take my desk and make more money than me? Is that the sort of feeling a little bit?
from the working first hour to the last hour of every day.
What? Okay.
I can't even explain the intensity of it. Like, but they're so good at brainwashing. They're so good at you know, making you feel that like every other recruitment firm is not even really a recruitment firm. You know, you, what you're doing is best because our process is best and we're the best and we got them, and that's reinforced all day long. And then they're constantly hiring. So, you know, you're there and you're just about comfortable. And then the next thing they're like, we want you to mentor this person, kind of, sort of,
yeah,
give them half your business. And then, then you're at it again, you know. And then my desk was divided four times whenever it was going well. And I remember thinking, that's terrible. I mean, it was the best thing I ever learned, to be honest. Them chopping up my desk taught me how to set up my own business. But somebody else who maybe was more suitable to leadership, it would have turned them into being a manager and towing the carpet line. But like yourself, I think I was a bit of a maverick.
Yeah, I that's the thing for me. It was strange because most people, I thought most people start a business, they probably went up through a big company, managed a team, and they learned how to do it, and then they had the confidence to go and start their own business. Whereas I never led a team. I just sort of, Josh and I just learned along the way. But in terms of the big companies, and you're talking about them being very clever at brainwashing and putting them all over your eyes, the one experience I have had with someone from one of the big firms, we'd been going a couple of years of E4, and we were working really hard to try and get things going, and we were starting to carve out a good name for ourselves. And then out of the blue one day on LinkedIn, I got a message from someone that had been for years, an older guy for years had been in one of the big companies. And he basically said, I've got a good redundancy package. I've got a stack of cash here and I want to invest into a little healthcare recruitment company. So I was sort of, because I was still sort of quite, you know, trying to find my way and stuff. I was really excited. But, oh my God, someone's noticed that we're doing really well and they want to talk to us about investing. This is amazing. So I thought this guy might just come in and give us loads of, you know, tips and help us grow the business. So
I can see where this is going.
Oh, I'm still embarrassed about it now. So he said, come and meet me for lunch and we'll, you know, talk about it, me investing and all this kind of stuff. So I dragged Josh along for it, and he was a bit like, what's going on here? So I dragged him along, sat for lunch, and that's it. Just poured everything out. This is how we grew the business. This is how you did well. This is the people we market to.
You want to name and shame this guy, hey?
No, I won't. They're one of our main competitors now. But yes, obviously, inevitably, he gave me some lowball offer, and I thought, that's a bit weird. And then about a month later, up sprung their aged care, healthcare recruitment company, and they're still one of our main competitors now. So yeah, so I get reminded of that every now and again about my how I helped set up one of my competitors' companies.
Oh, I bet he loves telling that story too, hey?
Oh, yeah. Oh, look, a massive lesson learned for me. But I just wide-eyed. I was like, oh, my God, someone's taking an interest in us. How well we're doing. This is great. But I found out that he did it to one of our other competitors as well. So it wasn't just me, at least.
You're going to give me that name off off air.
Yeah, we will do.
But I'm allowed five guesses, okay?
All right, yeah. We can play that game. I can do that.
so this call came about because you've been listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
And you know, you said, look, I'm not Greg Savage, I'm not Roy Ripper, but you know, I'm happy to come on.
I was worried I was going to underwhelm your listeners because I'm just a little business, and we haven't. I know you get trainers on and people that have done this amazing stuff. So yeah, I was a bit worried that I wasn't going to have anything to say. But yeah,
no. Well, we have independent recruiters. Everybody on the best stories are people's journeys, and you've gone on your own journey, and you've made it work. So I'm always excited to get small business owners on. And what type of stuff have you learned from listening to the podcast? Like, what type of things are you interested in right now?
Oh, the big one for me definitely has been the social media side of things. And I sort of dabbled in it a little bit, but probably done what a lot of other people did in sense of just put the odd post up and gone, no likes. No, this doesn't work. I'm not going to bother anymore. But from listening to some of your guests coming on and then sort of then following them and seeing what they're doing, I've really seeing the value now. I like the whole idea of becoming a celebrity almost in your niche. And it really excites me to think, you know, can you, and I don't think this will ever happen, but can you become that well known and I suppose respected in your little niche that you just don't have to do as much of the cold calling and the getting out there? Like, effectively, you know, people hear about you, know about you, feel comfortable with you. So clients call you about their jobs and candidates come to you because they know who you are. And that really excites me, the thought of that ever happening. So that's what I'm trying to sort of go in that direction now. And it's funny because I'm much more of the big dreamer type person, and Josh is much more a day-to-day sort of, you know, keep your feet on the ground type person. So I think that's why we've done well, because we sort of balance each other.
My wife's a bit like that as well. He sounds like your work wife.
Oh, massively. It's exactly that. We have that relationship. We don't hang out heaps outside of work, but we've always been really close in the office. Yeah, we argue, we have little bitchy fights and that, but it's just got better over time, and we just balance each other out. So that's been really good.
Yeah. So the social media piece is interesting. I'm still kind of halfway through figuring it out. I'm going to release an article later on 20 people you can follow if you want to learn this type of stuff. So I'm going to try and put that together. But I think it just takes a lot of work. And we've had some people that have definitely made it work for them, like to become famous within their niche on the show. Yeah. How many of them are actual practitioners in doing a desk on a day-to-day basis? Not sure. I would say that I don't know if anybody's actually got it 100% right just yet, but there's a couple of people, especially in America, that have got pretty close to it. So it's an ongoing thing, and I don't think it's easy, but I suppose you kind of have to work out where your audience is. Like who gives you the jobs at the moment? Are they men or women?
Mainly female, yeah.
So then a podcast wouldn't be a good idea, because apparently women don't listen to podcasts. I know. Isn't that somebody, a social media guy told me that recently. I haven't researched it, but it does make sense. If you look at like podcasters, how many men there are, if you talk to anybody about podcasting or who listens to it, it's always men, and women just kind of tell me they're not interested.
So because of you, I've had this dream, and then because of you, you just brought it crashing down as well.
No, but what you could do is you could do short video snippets. And you could go out to all the aged care places and talk to people about their dream, and bring one of your staff to video it, do a couple of segments, and go from there. Like I think that's what you have to do. You have to work out, like, who's your audience, what do they want to hear, and how can you go about delivering that?
But that's going down a whole new avenue, isn't it? It's one thing to sort of, you know, get on a podcast and just chat with people, but, you know, going down the video path, and I have been trying it. I've been, you know, making a fool of myself at home, practicing in front of the camera, trying to get some, you know, get the boss up to put some videos out, and I just look ridiculous. I'm going to persevere, and the guys in the office just laugh at me, because for about a year I've been saying, I'm going to start putting videos up, I'm going to do it. And I just, yeah, it's just daunting to get yourself up there, isn't it, on a video.
I'm the same as you. I've done a few, but I haven't really invested completely into it. So you've probably heard me talking, we're going to New York at the end of the month. I've hired a videographer to follow us around for 2 days, and we're going to do some live podcasts and speak to recruiters and do all of that the right way, and then I think we'll get that person to edit that and put it into bite-sized chunks, and that's kind of where I feel comfortable. If there's a professional behind the camera, kind of know, okay, well, you're going to help me not look like as big a knob as I will if I just put my phone up.
It's so off-putting, putting your phone on a tripod and then just turn it on standing there.
It's really horrible, hey?
And I didn't realize it zapped your energy so much. You have to be really energetic and then to come across normal. If you just stand there talking, you just look just boring, and just there's no life to it whatsoever.
Yeah, it's really hard, but I think it's like anything. It's just practice, and half the problem we all have is that 90% of the people who are doing videos on LinkedIn do look like knobs at the moment. So, so you're like, can I be the 10% that doesn't look like a knob? How can I do that? And we're in this weird place where we're recruitment companies that are almost trying to become media companies, and we have no training in copywriting.
But we're just jumping in and going,
and just being awkward about it. So it's like, I don't have it figured out, but like, I mean,
and how do you get in that 10% that are decent, and how do you know if you're in the 10%? Because you more than likely you think, I've nailed it, I'm in the 10%, but everyone else is going, well, look at this idiot, look at this fool in front of the camera. So we have a great laugh at, you know, at the people putting their videos up, and then the companies that do their promotional. Like, I know there was that parody one that went round that everyone had a big laugh about, but even other companies have done the thing where, you know, they walk in and high five each other, and they, you know, they're doing cartwheels around the office, and we just all sit there going, oh no, how can you ever make this actually good? It's going to be impossible.
Yeah, and I think the simple answer is you steal the credibility off the guest. So if I go to Australia, I go for a coffee with Greg Savage and I video it. And by association, he's the star of the show. I'm just asking questions, so it's hard for me to be the knob.
Yeah, they're there for him, and then you're just getting
Maybe I just have a chat about what I learned off him. So then I'm being magnanimous. And then you do that with the next person. And then you get to a person where maybe you know more than they do. And then maybe they ask you questions and you're able to kind of give that. And I think that's the evolution of the narrative that you can put together. But just standing there pontificating, there's a couple of people who do it, and it makes me cringe, because like, I feel I haven't achieved anything yet. So I don't want to go, you should do this, and like, this is how you do it, because...
Yeah,
you know, we get people, as you said, we get people on here who've exited 50 million pound businesses. So, like, and they're not doing it. So then, why should I?
What gives you the right to stand up there and tell people how to do things or listen to you? Yeah, that's definitely how I feel trying to come up. And that's the other thing, talking about what I've learned from your podcast. I think the big thing for people on social media, not talk about video, but just the content piece. And that's what I always struggled with, was just sat there trying to rack my brains thinking, what do I do? What do I do? And the one thing I've really learned and loved from the podcast is this whole documenting thing. And as soon as that sort of clicked into place, you just go, oh yeah, that's not that hard, is it? You just literally listen to what you get told on a daily basis, and then you just throw it out there onto your social media, say, oh, look, I heard this from a client, or I've been just discussing this with this person, and it just becomes much easier instead of having to try and think of something new and original to put up there.
Yeah, and the more that I do this, the more rabbit holes that open up. So then I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I find that the smartest people in our industry, and I'm going to hate myself for saying this, but a lot of them are internal recruiters. Are in that field, and they're much more into like what to do, where does the data come from, how do you get it, what to do with it, how do you create the narrative, how do you deliver that, how then do you remarket it and target that, and then how does that there all go into one thing, and they're far ahead of where the agency people are. And every time, like, I had Tris Revel on, he's led, like, speaking to him, I'm like, you know more than I do. And then I'm like, and then he introduces me to three or four other people who know way more than he does. And then I'm starting to get stressed out, because now I have to go and interview them and figure out what that is. And then that's where content comes, because you're not like researching and saying, I'm right, this is the way it is. You're going, oh, I'm a bit of a dummy. But this person's kind of bright. Why don't you listen to them?
He doesn't hold back, does he, Trish? I listened to his podcast the other day. He doesn't hold back, does he?
He doesn't hold back at all.
It was just like an hour argument. I quite enjoyed it, just listening to you two argue and sort of almost sounding frosty, but knowing that it isn't. It's just the way he sort of just delivers it with a lot of passion and you know.
Yeah, he's very passionate. I think we're on two opposite sides of the coin, to a point. Like he identifies himself much more in that internal recruitment gang, and I think a lot of that, they do look at the agency world like we're dinosaurs, and okay, some of the big firms are dinosaurs, but there's lots of smart people who are running independent recruitment firms. So what I enjoy speaking to him is sometimes we agree on stuff, and but I know he's going to argue with me the whole time.
Oh, no, it's a good listen. Yeah, but I like, in terms of you talking about the agency recruitment, I do enjoy how the industry changed, and I used to be very against change when I was doing well as working for a nascent and in my little bubble, and then like LinkedIn came out and things came out. I used to hate it. I was like, no, I'm doing well with what I'm doing. Just leave me alone. Don't change anything. But now I've completely done a U-turn. I like the change, because I think if you're part of the few that do embrace it and try and get ahead of things, then it gives you an edge over your competition, and it's more enjoyable as well. I like that it's just not the day-to-day grind. There's like the social media stuff, and it's just more, it just makes the job more enjoyable. I think you said before as well, since you've been doing the podcast, it's sort of given you a new enjoyment of doing your recruitment. And that's what I'm finding, I think, a little bit with trying to do other things new and change things up.
Yeah, I mean, it's really given me a new lease of life, you know, because when you sign up all the clients, you kind of know what they're after. And then you're basically marketing to get more candidates so you can deliver to them. And when that is just your job, like, you just, like, after a while, you're like, you know, surely there must be more to this. Like, I really want to learn something different. And this has just opened up that whole spectrum of learning and getting to kind of speak to people who are really successful. And like, I've never spoken to Roy Ripper before he came on the podcast. And that was just a trip, getting to hear his story and all the rest, and talking to him beforehand and after. He took up half my day with banter.
Yeah. He was the first recruiter out there that I ever found and listened to. I used to think he was great. I used to listen to, he was the first sort of person out there talking about the recruitment world and training and stuff. So I used to watch his videos, and so I was quite glad when it came up that Roy Ripper was on your podcast, because I'm the same. I thought he was awesome the way he comes across.
Yeah, he's great. We're going to do a meeting him in Brighton with
this is your roundtable thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so can't wait. So we're gonna do that, and it might be awful in terms of like the content that comes out of it, or it might be great. I'd like to think that between him, Barry, who's been on the podcast, the recruitment lawyer, and Mark Sanowski, who's had a major exit with Eurostaff, that there's three people there that we can talk about anything that comes up in the industry. And I can just ask questions basically and let them rabbit on and talk like men like to when they're over 40.
Oh, look, but like with the podcast, and until you try it and risk it and just have a crack at it, you're not going to know, are you? And I'm sure it'll go well once it happens.
So if we do a follow up on this in 18 months, are you going to be the Tom Cruise of aged care recruitment? Are you going to have over 50 people working for you? Are you going to be taking over the world, or are you going to be dipping your toe back into the mining industry, taking down some big fees and buying a new ute and moving to Western Australia?
Ideally both, to be honest. I know it's probably a bit of a cop out, but yeah, we've really enjoyed healthcare, really enjoyed aged care. And yes, I think healthcare's a growth area over here. There's lots of offshoots to what we do already. So we just want to expand the company into those other areas like pharmaceutical and anything related to the healthcare and medical industry. But yeah, when we first started the company, there was no plans to grow it and have this massive empire or anything. But as time went on, it's become more enjoyable to, I think things take over. When you first start a company, it's all about just being successful and making a load of money. And then I think as time goes on, if you're trying to scale up, almost that stuff becomes the enjoyable part. And you know, challenging yourself to bring more people on, and it does become more stressful, definitely. There's more staff you get, but it also becomes more enjoyable, I find. So, yeah, I want to grow. I want us to grow and go a lot bigger. And if mining comes back, it's not directly linked with healthcare, but if it comes back, then, yeah, I think we'd have to, go back into it and have a shot. And
Just go get a new brand.
That's what I was going to ask you, actually, what your view is. Do you just say we've now got E4 division mining that doesn't really link up with this other stuff, but that's what we're doing as well? Or do you do that other brand? Do you just start a completely different company as a, you know, as under the umbrella, but it's different in everyone else's eyes?
It's a good question. Does any of it really matter?
Probably not. As long as you're doing the job right and you're out there working hard, it probably doesn't, does it?
No, like, I mean, from an SEO perspective, and like, you might want to have a, like, be Aussie, or like, you might want to be mining recruitment, or you might want to have like a catchy name or something like that. Yeah. But really, I don't know if it makes that big a difference. Like, I don't think you having a mining brand will damage your healthcare.
Well, I hope that's the case, because I would rather keep it all under the same banner and just be seen as a company that's growing and expanding to other areas. I'd rather do that. But just a couple of people said, it doesn't really marry up with it. Maybe you should look at having a different brand. But no, I'd much rather keep it under the same, you know, same name.
Because what's your company called again?
E4.
E4. So, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a nondescript name, right? So
not linked, like, to the healthcare.
The name isn't linked to the niche that you're in. So I don't see how having any of it in, like, going after a new area will damage it. But hey, what do I know? I'm gonna try and get a guy on who's doing my branding or on the podcast.
Yeah,
I've been chasing him for a while, but he goes into the science of it all, and it's really interesting. And he loses me every time after about 10 minutes.
You just find yourself wandering off. Yeah,
I find myself going, I wonder if I can take the job in Australia today.
Yeah,
you know. But Ed, it's been great having you on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and I will have a wee chat off air so I can be better at RectorAct for healthcare.
Yeah, in finding some candidates, that'd be fantastic. But no, I've really enjoyed coming on. I was nervous to come on, but it's been thoroughly enjoyable. So yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks, mate. You've been an awesome guest.
Cheers, mate.
What a nice lad Edward is. And you can see, you know, how personable he is goes a long way and why he's successful. And he's open to new things, and he's been using this podcast to really learn off some of the experts that we've had on here, and he did mention to me beforehand, look, I don't know about coming on, because, you know, you've had Greg Savage on, you've had Roy Ripper, and you've had these people who've done amazing things, and I'm only at the start of my journey. And one of the things I had to explain to Edward was that In your eyes, you're not very successful, or you're just starting out. But to somebody who's sitting at Hayes or Michael Page, and they're doing their KPIs and they're having to wear their suit and all the rest, to own a recruitment business that has 10 people billing and you're living in Sydney, you've achieved an unbelievable amount. So we can't be too worried about putting ourselves out there. None of us know it all. And as you've seen from the interview, Edward's a thoughtful, smart dude, and he'll do really well. So big thanks for him to come on. Really enjoyed the conversation. And yeah, sound lad. All right. We'll be back later on today with another podcast, I hope. I think I'm going to America. All right. Talk then.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.